Hey, Danger Dan Jurz here with a quick announcement. Our next interstitial bonus content will be Daniel's Power Rangers mini campaign, and it will be the final one before the start of Season 2 officially begins. It's a soft Season 1 epilogue slash side story that will be releasing exclusively on Patreon, with its first episode dropping Wednesday, May 27th. Stick around after the episode to hear a sneak preview. More details about Season 2 will be coming soon, so keep an ear out and enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to Table Talk, a show where I chat with other creators in the TTRPG space about how they run their tables. I'm Danger Dan Jurz, the GM and host of D&D Dark, and joining us at the table today is a player, GM, and TTRPG designer who has been featured on numerous shows such as Dice Fiends, RPG R&D, and the 2025 Crit Awards winner for Best Series, The Queer XP, Jonathan Greenall, aka Starshine Scribbles. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So to get us started, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself, your history in the TTRPG space, and about the various projects you're involved in?
Well, I've been in TTRPG space now for, I've been saying 3 years, I think now, for about 5 years. So I probably have to at some point work that out again. I don't want to because I mean, I'm getting old. No, I've been making games for several years now. I've been involved in a lot of different projects. I said a lot of my own games. The one people probably know me for is you have one ability, the ability to fuck this up. And my girlfriend has turned into a car and we're escaping the city. I've also worked on the Level 1 collection, done some games for that. I was one of the writers for Capers Cyberpunk and Roll for Learning, which is an educational compendium of games for classroom use. I'm the lead writer for Library of Words, which is a TTRPG review site. I've also written for The Hearth magazine, and I've also done video game writing for stuff like Lost in Cults, Console Chronicles, Gamebook Advance, and places like Polygon, and quite a few places. My list is slowly growing. And another thing people probably know me for is that I also maintain the TTRPG Creators Resources Master Post, which is aiming to help people find the resources they need to make games. I wear too many hats, is what I'm quickly learning.
I understand that entirely. You are extremely prolific, and I really admire that about you. You've got a very large body of work that is very versatile. Let's start with your involvement on the different shows that you've been a part of, either as a performer in the actual play space or for your games being represented through actual play. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience has been like on either side of that and the like different things that you've learned from that?
It's always fun to be involved in that. I love the actual play sphere. It's one of my favorite things to do. I wish I had more time to be able to do it more often, but taking recordings is always a pain. I think as a designer, the thing you're going to learn very quickly is hearing your work be played is never, it's cool, but it's never not awkward. There's always something weirdly voyeuristic about it. One of my favorite things that ever happened to me was Party of One, which is a great podcast. Jeff Stormer played All I Want for Christmas is to Get Out of This Fucking Mall one Christmas, which is a game I made. And they did ask me beforehand, but I had totally forgotten about it. So I was going to the airport to travel to see family for Christmas. And I saw them in the morning, like, oh, Party of One, your episode's been downloaded. Like, cool, I'm going to sit at the airport. Get in the game, sat in the airport. Jeff starts talking. Well, the first thing he says is the intro to the game, like the little bit of flavor text I wrote. I'm like, this sounds weirdly familiar. Where have I heard this before? Then he's like, oh, now I can't listen to this. Like, I can't sit here in the airport and like listen to this for fun. Because I naturally end up just analyzing what's going on. It does lead to some cool things. I think one thing it definitely has taught me, though, is that you can give players the benefit of the doubt much more than you think. Players are usually fair actors. They're not going to try and purposely ruin your game for you. You can leave things vague and they will read between the lines perfectly acceptably. I think this is something a lot of new designers deal with, is that you always feel a temptation to over-explain your rules, sort of to, I always call it pantomime acting, make sure Row Z totally gets what you're going at. But you don't have to. Most players will be perfectly happy to either read between the lines or go with it until they pick up what you're putting down. So you have to be super explicit, which I think is a really nice thing. And just everyone's going to bring something different to your game. I think that's something you've got to accept, is that I know Death of the Author has become a meme in some circles, but it is the truth. People are going to take things in ways you didn't expect. People are going to use things in ways you didn't expect. I've had people explain to me really cool mechanical interactions they've seen, you know, in their games. Like, oh, you must have spent ages developing that. I was like, what? Wait, what? You can do that? Well, I guess I didn't say you couldn't do that. Okay. And tip, if someone says that, you say, yes, I did spend ages designing it. Thank you for noticing. claim the credit, because you know, sometimes the happy accidents are the best thing. Oh, man, being a player is, again, it's a really fun experience. Some of my favorite things. I think one thing, again, it's another thing about sort of trusting yourself. In the same way we say that players, you know, will be good actors, you can also be a fair actor to yourself. There's a real temptation when you're doing, sort of, especially early ones, to overthink the things you say and be like, oh, I stumbled over that word. Now everyone's going to think I'm an idiot. Most people won't notice. I had that recently. I host a podcast, not a TTRPG one, but there was a gag. I was like, oh, man, I could deliver that better. And then the other two people I do the podcast with are like, well, that was fine. What? I was like, well, I stumbled over the word. Did you? Because people aren't going to, sort of, are micromanaging your performance. They're not, you know, you don't have a Kubrick in the wings who is going to, you know, burn the set down because you, you know, said they're slightly wrong. So just, you got to relax, take it as it goes. I always suggest having notes. Notes are my comfort item. Having notes around is great, especially if you're doing the crunchy game. Just if you think, oh, I can never remember that rule, write it down, stick it behind you. I have a little piece of cardboard that's, even when I've got this recording this, it's there. I just stick notes to it sometimes. Like, okay, cool. If I need to, you know, that rule I can't remember, there it is. I can just consult it. And again, if you need to take that moment, people won't notice and won't be like, oh, they haven't memorized the rules. They are the new Satan. They're just like, okay, I took a breath.
I relate to that in a major way. As a creator in the actual play space who edits his own show and frequently interacts with other people in the space, it's a common discussion that comes up a bunch is that player brain, editor brain, director brain, and audience brain all perceive different things. And it's amazing what in the moment feels a lot bigger than it is, and what you take for granted that the audience will pick up on and jump to. But that's the thing that I always brush up against when I'm discussing with other editors of their shows. If we ever get to a place of exchanging notes, they very frequently will not cling onto the pressure and stress points that I do. We do not notice each other's seams, but are very cognizant of our own, like, oh, I could have said that better. All my other players performed perfectly and made no mistakes whatsoever, but I could have done X, Y, Z so much better. What do you mean they made mistakes? What do you mean they think they could do better? Their performance is perfect. So it really is just an interesting perspective game.
Especially if you edit your own stuff. I edit my own stuff as well. And it's like, things feel very differently when you hear them for the first time and when you hear it 67 times in about 25 minutes. You will slowly start hating yourself. And I think it's something you have to overcome. It's like, the audience is not repeatedly listening to this. Same when you're editing a game. They'll be like little bits like, oh man, I could have done that. You know, I could have blended that picture slightly better. It's like, but they don't know that's there. It is the mountain out of a molehill thing. If you don't know the molehill's there, you're not going to really notice it. And if you do, you'll be like, oh, moles. But if you've spent months working on the garden, you'll be like, oh my God, the moles are back. It's like, for most people, it's just like, oh, yeah. One of the most unfortunate things, it's not something there's a quick fix to. You just kind of have to get used to it or reach that point of self-loathing where it kind of loops back around as an overflow error. It's like, that's what I have now when I go and edit other podcasts. Like, I know I hate how I sound, but I already know that. So it's not really surprising for me. So it's just become this kind of thing like, okay, this sounds like crap, but no one else has complained. So we're just going to presume that this is how it's meant to sound.
It's kind of similar to the acting side of things. I know it's a really common perspective that a lot of people jump into for any kind of voice acting endeavor or anything where they have to listen to themselves repeatedly or see themselves on camera. That's a hurdle that almost everyone has to jump over is, oh man, is that really how I sound? Is that really how I look? Oh, I can't stand watching or listening to myself. And it's just a thing you have to numb yourself to. After enough sheer exposure to it, you eventually stop noticing and can start looking at it from a more academic lens of like, what objectively can I improve about this? Can I break this down into a science so that I take myself out of the equation? I was an intern for a voiceover recording studio that did voice acting classes for a while. And that was a huge thing that every single class had to jump over. And almost never was there anybody who was not in that same boat of, man, I have to really go out of my way to force myself to listen to my work because I can't stand hearing my own voice. No matter how pleasant their voice is, no matter how good their delivery is, that's just a universal constant.
Yeah, especially with actual play as well. There is that whole point of they are more freeform. you could sit there all night and say that, oh, well, you know, if I had a script for this, I could have done X, Y, and Z. But if you're scripting it, you're not doing the medium. The medium is inherently messy. I always say when I've taught actual play people, you shouldn't be sort of looking at produced works for your sort of inspiration. You should be looking at something like improv more, because, you know, often the thing you need to learn isn't I need to be perfect, it's how to roll with things going wrong. And, you know, and sometimes you say one of the best things I could say is if you are running a game, you've got to have different options and not be too committed to any of them. If things go absolutely left field, what is your way of pulling that back? Though I would always say use the common GMing cheat, and that is if the players haven't seen something, then it could be anywhere. It's Schrodinger's, you know, it's Schrodinger's enemy, it's Schrodinger's item. Sure, they were meant to find it in the other room, but they just walked right past. Well, it's in this other room. It's always been in this other room because it hasn't been. It's sure in your on your map, it may have a little marker, but if you've never said it, no one else knows. If you just shuffle it into the other room, move everything 2 feet to the left.
It's such a great catch-all, and it lends itself really nicely to my GM philosophy. I tend to approach games as I anticipate obstacles. I do not anticipate solutions. And there's kind of two schools of thought there. There are the kind of GMs that come up with five different solutions to every problem you present them, or never anticipate any solution, just know what obstacles you are planning to put in the player's way, and then leave the problems open-ended for them to solve however they will, because you can never truly anticipate everything your players will do, and the stuff that surprises you usually gives you the most ammunition going forward.
Yeah, you have to accept that some things, so sometimes things are going to go off. And yeah, knowing how to pull things back, I think, is probably a more important skill than knowing how to set things up. A big chunk of it is just overcoming that everything's gone wrong freeze. And sometimes that does mean accepting that, you know, you have to be more upfront about it. I think there's a kind of this worry that from people who highly edited shows that everything is going to sound smooth. And if it sort of sounds messy, or if it sounds like I'm having to sort of go on the back foot, people are going to look down on that. No, actually, a lot of the times the bits people love are those moments. One of my biggest inspirations is Aid Edmondson. He was a British comedian. He made the show Bottom and the Young Ones. They did live shows for many years. And quite often when something went wrong or one of them messed up a line, Aid would just be like, well, we ruined that, didn't we? And just tangent into this, like, really just improv spur of the moment set while they pulled it back. And those are some of the funniest moments of those shows. And the audience always love them because it's that moment of like, oh, hey, we're all in this together. We're all having, none of us know where this is going. And that's exciting. No, because this isn't the same show that's been every night for the last 2 years. This is a unique moment. And the same with actual play. Sometimes, you know, you can be fully upfront that this is going in a way we didn't see coming, but hey, we're going to roll with it. And, you know, you're in on this. This is exciting. Something different is happening.
Yeah, it makes me think of how a lot of the most legendary Saturday Night Live sketches are the ones that completely fall apart and crash in on themselves. There's a certain charm to watching things go off the rails. And even though it's not exclusively a live medium, even with the like edited and produced shows, you're in the moment performing as though you are live. And I've found a good piece of wisdom: if you treat a tabletop RPG game as not performing for an audience, but performing for the people in the room with you, at a certain point, you have to ignore the audience and treat your table as your audience. And as long as your table is bought in and having fun on everything that is going on and you keep them engaged, the audience will prefer that to you pandering to them.
I think it's true, any sort of form of art. You've got, at some point, you've got to ignore the audience. I mean, it's an old P.T. Barnum joke that the audience doesn't know what they want until you tell them what they want. but for all the man's flaws, it is actually true.
And I know that that's a stumbling block that some of the bigger shows have gotten into. One of the big points of inspiration for me for my show was Dungeons and Daddies. In their Patreon, they do a basically post-show discussion, and there's a lot of really good nuggets of actual play wisdom that goes into that. And one of the things that they talked about a bit with their second season, which is their kind of polarizing one, was that they were very aware that they were kind of becoming beholden to their audience, and they were internalizing audience feedback and critique in real time a little bit too much. And so that's a danger to watch out for. And letting things be messy and letting them have issues, even in terms of starting off and being less polished and turning into something with higher production value going forward. I've chatted with a few fans of the show, and that's a thing that it's always a little bizarre to me as an editor being so close to the project that I can't see this about my own show, but I can definitely see it about other people's shows, that part of the charm for a longer running show is seeing the improvement over time. So the messiness at the beginning has a lot of charm to a certain subset of the audience because it lends an air of authenticity to it and lets you see and feel the show grow with its players.
Yeah. I think that's also one thing you always got to consider is that no one's first draft is going to be perfect, and you work with that how you do. We have the term early installment weirdness for a reason, and that is on with TV, pilots didn't used to be broadcast very often unless a show was big, and even the pilot they broadcast would be pilot 3, pilot 4. But yeah, everything, even the biggest shows have messy. Go back to the, I like to bring this up to people, go back to the very first episode of Seinfeld. It looks noticeably worse. It's shot noticeably worse. The timing is off on everything. It's mad. You know, one probably reason my favorite shows is Mystery Science Theater 3000. You go back and look at Joel when he was on KTMA and how the first episode of KTMA is literally held together with spit and sellotape. No one knows what they're doing. Joel is exhausted. Then you sort of see this rhythm form. You see everyone sort of get, okay, this is what we're doing. And then after that, they sort of start building it up. It's like, okay, we're going to improve the puppets. We're going to build this sort of arc nature into it. And it works. You're not going to be perfect on the first go. And that's unfortunate because, God, it'd be lovely to be perfect on the first go, wouldn't it? But if you're perfect on the first go, you wouldn't get some of the really nice coincidences. Yeah, out of those early experiments, things develop in a way that you maybe wouldn't expect. And you pick up on things you normally wouldn't. You know, some of my best things have come about due to messing up.
Absolutely. There's some really great running jokes and gags that you can get from that. And comedy in particular, I know a lot of sitcoms have historically run into that hurdle that almost every sitcom struggles with their first season before they lock into their formula and find their identity. They, more than dramas, comedies really need time to find their footing and figure out their unique dynamic and energy, which is why sitcoms in their truest forms are pretty rare these days, just because the media ecosystem doesn't allow for that kind of development time for a show to find its identity. If it's not an instant success, it's tossed out.
Oh, yeah. One of my favorite accidents was when I ran for the Career XP, when we ran Locus for them. One of the biggest and most impactful plot points in that whole episode is the fact that one character changes appearance because it's a hint to the fact that it's actually her sister. But that whole plot point came around because when I was talking through the plot with a friend, I realized midway through that my original description said she had brown hair. Then my later one said she had blonde hair. My friend was like, wait, her hair's changed color. And I was like, well, that'd be a really good way to hint something's really that she's not who that other person is. And then that just stayed in. And it's the bit I've had people comment. It's like, oh, that was a really good twist. I was like, it was literally because I was running at 4 a.m. I forgot what color my character's hair was. I didn't notice until I was doing a prep read.
That's fantastic. So to circle back around to some of your shows and your works, I want to take a look at where your inspiration points are, what you're primarily drawing upon, because you've referenced quite a few things and you've got a really wide body of work that hits on a lot of different genres. You've got more comedy focused games, more horror, sci-fi, anime send-ups, stuff that is direct supplements to 5e. So when you're putting those together, what do you tend to draw from the most as an inspiration point to get the process started? And is there any particular design philosophy that you lean on that you like to explore? There are like certain mechanics that get stuck in your head that you want to fiddle around with? Is it kind of a combination of everything? What does the creation process generally look like for you?
You know, I'm a big believer in never having one inspiration. Why have one when you can have six?
Yeah.
One of the most important things you can do is never box yourself into one inspiration. If you start just doing the same thing over and over again, it's going to show and you're going to start hating yourself pretty quickly. I flip between bottom-up and top-down design as well, depending on projects. Sometimes there is a project where I'm like, I have an idea for a mechanic. That was, for instance, Poulter, which is my ghost hunting game. That was entirely based on the idea of me really liking the idea of a game where you have to try and erase a picture as quickly as humanly possible. Other times I come in with just a concept I like. So a game I'm working on at the moment called War Maiden is specifically because I just got really into Gundam for a brief, well, got back into Gundam for a bit. And I just love the idea of like, how do you do a solo game where you manage a group of mech pilots and slowly get them all killed for fun? Yeah, which then these things build. You know, I pull on a lot of stuff generally. I think it's important to do that because it keeps you fresh. It keeps your games fresh. One of the... my biggest influence ever was House of Leaves. I think that book is a great example of how you can just break every single rule in the book, every piece of writing advice. One of my favorite, I can't remember who told the joke now, but it was the House of Leaves drinking game is to take a shot every time it breaks one of the rules of literature. And then by the end, you'll end up as mad as the characters are. Because yeah, it just breaks every single rule, but it works. And it clearly knew what it was trying to do. Same here. And I'm also, yeah, there's a lot of, I could list off 100 things I'm a big fan of. I'm a massive fan of William Castle, the film director, whose whole thing was, what's the stupidest gimmick I can give this film? So like House on Haunted Hill, he strung up skeletons in the ceiling and had them fly at the audience. He made seats vibrate. You know, it's that kind of just inherent just weirdness. And similarly, I love David Lynch. He was always never afraid to be like, this is what interests me. You know, I think one thing that never gets appreciated enough for me is that Twin Peaks is not just like this high concept show. It is at its core a parody of trashy soap operas. And Lynch observes them perfectly while never looking down on them as a medium. You can tell he liked them. You know, that's such a good thing for me as well. You know, take your inspirations, look at them, play with them however you feel like. And yeah. Probably one of my other inspirations is Akira Toriyama. Toriyama did something with Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z that I think more writers need to take into, which is if you in the moment make something out to be the coolest thing in the world, the audience, they'll go with you. Because you sit back and you look at Dragon Ball synopsis and it is the stupidest, stupidest show in existence. Like you look at the transition from Dragon Ball to Dragon Ball Z. Oh, the character was an alien all along. In most shows, that would get you killed. That's a terrible idea. Except in that first episode of Z, he introduces Raditz and basically says, hey, Raditz, the coolest guy in the world. See this other cool guy you've liked? They're going to fight and it's going to be awesome. And everyone's like, yeah, cool. Yeah, I want to see that. And that's what you've got to do, you know, pull things together and go on, you know, this is what I want to do. I think it's cool. And again, I'm going to make you think it's cool. This is not optional. You will come over here, Sonny Boy, and accept this. So that is, you know, why a lot of my games are these weird mishmashes of different things. You know, not everything has to be a one-to-one. It's a thing I hark on a lot. One of my least favorite things in the world is Michelangelo. I hate the dude. Because of his, I saw the angel in the marble and set her free. Nonsense. He was very good. But the fact that became sort of this thing of like, oh, inspiration is from the divine. That's why it was pushed, because the Rangel's artist was sponsored by the church who presented it of the inspiration of the divine. That's bollocks. Pure bollocks. If you want to make something, you just do it. If you think something's interesting, I can make a game around this, do it. I think something I see with a lot of new developers, and I've talked to them quite a few, this is even in video games as well, is they sit around going, well, I haven't had the inspiration. Like, you know, the sky opens up and they're like, no, sometimes you just got to go, huh, that could be funny. So I've had games I've designed where I literally have sat there gone, man, I wonder if you can make a game with only the D1, which is a ball. That'd be really stupid. Let's do it and see what happens. It doesn't have to be big.
Yeah, there's a philosophy that I like a lot more and that I've heard a lot of musicians will tend to harp upon is if you wait for a muse and for inspiration to strike, you will never make anything. You have to get the ball rolling yourself and you have to start the process and be confident that the inspiration will follow and will strike you when you set the table for it. Another thing that I also want to touch on that you brought up a bunch is how important sincerity is in the work that you're doing. And I think that that's kind of the overlap with what you brought up with Akira Toriyama and with David Lynch, is they really genuinely believe in their own work. And with Twin Peaks being kind of a parody and send-up of soap operas, it's coming from a place of love rather than a place of ridicule makes a parody work so much more often than the latter. All of the parodies that I have hated the most are clearly coming from a place where they detest the source material, and it just feels bad. One of my favorite movies of all time is Young Frankenstein, and you can tell the love and adoration that Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder had for the classic horror movies, and the Frankenstein movies in particular. Similarly, not to necessarily toot our own horn with our bonus content on D&D Dark, but one of the things that we've gotten as consistent praise for in some of our bonus content when we did our Scooby-Doo parody, Call of Cthubidoo, and our Muppets parody, Muppet Alien, is that we really made a point of trying to celebrate the thing that we were parodying rather than ridicule it and come at it from a place of genuine love and care and passion for the source material, which we've gotten numerous comments and praise for that shining through. I really look at that sincerity as a very critical and important ingredient in anything that you do. As soon as you're starting to do a project like this, whether it's actual play or any other creative endeavor, as soon as you're coming at it from a place of cynicism is when you need to get out of the game.
Yeah, I think that's a thing. You can chase trends and it doesn't really ever work. It has a shelf life because you will slowly die on the inside. You've got to be having fun. It's hard to do. And it's something that a lot of people struggle with. It's obviously the big thing, especially when you start doing a podcast or switching from external to intrinsic motivation, which you've got to work through that. And I think it's also why I say the whole thing about reading, watching widely is so important, because it keeps things fresh. It keeps things exciting. You know, it gives you new ways of looking at things. Don't just feel like you've got to keep doing the same thing on a loop until the day you finally snuff it. You know, and sometimes that means taking big swings, and those big swings will be, even if your audience ends up not liking it, you'll have a good time. I think that's important. It goes back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, sometimes you got to treat your audience with just a little bit of disdain. And that is the case as I was going, like, sure, I know I could make this game that would do well, but I don't want to. I want to make this thing that I like, and I'm going to convince you that thing I like is the thing you're going to like. And if you don't, well, tough. There will be another game along for you from me or someone else whenever. Deal with it.
That kind of strikes on another one of the criticisms that I have of the modern entertainment industry and media landscape is I feel like test audiences are a blight on modern entertainment. And there's like a real case study that I can look to that's been in the zeitgeist for a little while is since James Gunn's new Superman movie came out, there's been a lot of vocal discussion about the things that test audiences pointed out that they criticized that he spited them by keeping in anyway, and it's some of the more praised aspects of the movie. Like the famous one being during the big kaiju fight, the fact that Superman goes out of his way to save a squirrel and a dog from being collateral damage in this big catastrophe is really critically important to the character's ethos and value on protecting all life, and I think makes him significantly more interesting. And that was a thing that test audiences pushed back on and that James Gunn couldn't bring himself to take out of the movie and said, no, this has to be in here. This is too important to me, and is one of the things that people hold up who are fans of that movie as like, this is a distillation of what you got right about the character. So absolutely, at a certain point, you can only take audience consideration so far before you have to stick with your own gut and do the story that is important to you to tell.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to know how long that's been a problem, there's a Simpsons, season 6, 7, has a joke of the guy when he gets the kids and he tells them to rate Itchy and Scratchy, and they say they want a grounded show with dragons. You know, people aren't a microcosm. I can never remember it. There is a German word for the realization that everyone has an internal life. Oh, Sonder, that's it. Everyone has an internal life as complex as yours. Keep that in mind when you're developing games, and that you will realize that there is no way to sort of perfectly market in. You're never going to get that. And, you know, that does mean some projects are doomed to fail. But if you have a good time with them, then you learn something and you improve something. And said sometimes down the line, you get praise for things you didn't expect. I've had games I put out, didn't do very well. Then like 6 months later, I get people like, oh, man, I really enjoyed that. It's like, cool. Then my work here is done. Making games is about amusing yourself publicly. And if you're not having fun, that the audience can tell. I mean, I always sort of remember when you go to the, like, you ever heard people who go to see like an older band and their just heart isn't in it anymore?
Mm-hmm.
God, I remember when I saw the band Wishbone Ash, you know, who are an old blues band. There was like one guy from the original band left and he just had like a, looked like he was sucking a lemon all night. It's like, well, Mother of Pearl's the song I love, but when you're stood there going to sing it with no passion, it's like, well, maybe it's time to sit down, man. Maybe it's time to just say, well, we're done.
Absolutely. For me personally, I have so much more respect for a project that took a massive risk and it didn't pay off than one that played it safe and did okay. I would much rather see a bold, ambitious failure than a bland, safe success.
Yeah, I mean, that is entirely true. So one of the other projects I run is a podcast called Toonami Absolution, and we're going through Cartoon Network and Toonami history, and that's been our recurring thing. We've found some films that we have watched and gone, this was the worst thing we've ever seen, but it was so, so weird that you can't stop watching it. And then I have seen things that are clearly trying to sell me a toy and gone, this is technically fine, but it made me want to get up, turn it off, and never do this podcast again in my life because I was bored. One of my favorite films ever is a film called The Apple, which is absolutely terrible. It is a rock musical set in 1994. You know this because they say it's 1994 16 times a minute. The lead character is from Moose Jaw, which is part of the reason I love it, which is like the Canadian town you come up with when you want to say this person is from nowhere. And it's entirely a retelling of Genesis. It is poorly put together. The songs suck. But everything is made into a weird sci-fi prop. Half the actors are from East Berlin and don't speak any English. And you can tell the guy made it had so much faith in this project. He was willing to burn every bridge possible to make it. And I have more fun watching The Apple, watching its awfully composed ending than I do watching, I don't want to pick something out because I'm going to get emails, but generic drama number 5 where it's like, okay, here's the bit where we go for the Oscar. Here's the bit where we show. It's like magic. If I know where the trick's going, it's not fun. The whole point of the trick, I'm going to go, wow, okay, cool. History is full of big swings that sometimes don't work, but they leave a lasting impact. The phrase cult classic is a thing for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I say even in TTRPG, some of my favorite games are weird, unusual. Maybe they're not the best, but how they stand out. Like one of my favorite games is Apollo 47 Technical Manual. It is one of the clunkiest, most painful, most hard to play games in the world. But goddamn, it's brilliant because of that. Because it clearly had this idea of like, let's make people role play a moon landing. Not sand the edges off. This isn't Kerbal. You're going to sit there and you're going to read the bloody manual, boy. And the fact that, you know, I can then say that's a game I remember because it was so unique to anything else. One of my favorite games is Chaotic. The best review of Chaotic I can give you is that it is basically unplayable. But the entire book is, not Chaotic. Chaotic is another game that is playable, but it's also very, very weird. Human-occupied landfills game I'm thinking of, which is basically unplayable. But the entire book is handwritten. It's all just like scrawled in pen. It's such an experience. And it is a game I remember much more fondly than many bigger games because I've just seen nothing like it before. And I've seen nothing like it since.
That brings me back. That makes me nostalgic for... During the 2020 lockdowns, my COVID hobby was I got into the homebrew scene for the board game Disney Villainous, and there was a lot of discourse about quality versus ambition, and a lot of the ones that I remember from the homebrew scene and that I have a fondness for are ones that were criticized for not being the most technically polished, and there were quite a few that were like objectively better designed and put together. But I don't remember the safe ones anywhere near as much as I remember the ones that took a real big swing. There's a couple that were literally unplayable in a physical space and that you had to have tabletop simulator in order to go through. It would be impossible to replicate in person where they involved destroying the board, destroying the cards, or you have to spawn in like 6 separate boards and refresh and reshuffle the deck each time as you move from one phase to the next. And they had a reputation, both positively and negatively, for being so out there, but they're the ones that I really remember. And one that I have mixed feelings about myself that was kind of a personal landmark for me was I made, it's definitely not my best designed one, but it's one that has a cult following. I made a custom that is, for a while, I don't know anymore because I've been out of the scene for so long, but was considered within like the top 3 to 5 most complicated customs that exist. And it had a cult following because of its complexity and because it was so out there and took so many wild swings. And it's one that I had mixed feelings about and got a lot of heat for. since I ingratiated myself more to the like technical side of the community. They had a curation team and everything, and it went into a direction that I didn't enjoy. I left because there was a lot of weird internal politics with the scene, but that sticks in my mind. The custom was for the villain of season 3 of the DuckTales reboot. I made a custom for Bradford Buzzard, and it was a very simple gameplay premise on paper, but quickly spiraled out of control. The premise of it was basically that you had a chaos meter that you needed to get down to 0, and every interaction with your board would make things more and more chaotic. And so there were mechanics flying in from all over the place as every different card would make your game state more and more unruly, and your job would be to simplify it down and wipe the slate clean, get everything manageable. And it was tons of fun, but had a reputation for being one of the most complicated games that exist because there were so many different things to keep track of. And it was a very polarizing one for that reason, but it was damn well a memorable one.
There's something fun about that, though. You know, I think there's something really good about games that fight you back a little bit. You know, I think that's why, look at Balatro, I think is a great example of a polished way of doing that. Balatro is against you most of the time, but when you crack it, it feels amazing because you feel like it hasn't handed you the victory on a plate. You've had to mess around and find weird synergies. Same with one of my favorite games, Binding of Isaac. Binding of Isaac is one of the most player-unfriendly games ever. But that works, because when you go, oh, right, Brimstone and Dr. Fetus make Brimstone bombs that clear the stage, or, oh, right, if I take the Bible into Mom, she dies immediately, and then Satan kills me if I've got the Bible. It's having that idea of fighting against. One of my favorite games ever made is a game called Cosmology of Kyoto, which is, I think, is a game that literally hates you. When you die, you have to go through the Buddhist cycles of reincarnation. It makes you sit through them.
Oh, no.
Like, you have to, like, slowly walk and decay and then die. And the puzzles are incomprehensible. You encounter a monster a few times and you have to give them something. The only way to know that is to consult the game's in-game encyclopedia, which is not an encyclopedia of game mechanics. It is literally the encyclopedia of Heian they uploaded into the game. So it's just a book. And it is like, so it's, I've shown this to friends, I've streamed it, my whole thing, like, this game is unfair. It often doesn't work, but it is the best experience you'll ever have, because by being unfair, it really gives the game this creepy, weird atmosphere that, like, when you go against it, you do feel like, oh man, I am fighting against this, you know, trickster god that is only stopped if I give it a rice pan. Yeah, this is how it would interact. Knowing that stuff makes these games better. Talking of games sort of similar that doesn't hate you as much, is one thing I'm always admired by is the Sailor Moon TTRPG they made. I'm biased, I love Sailor Moon. One of my favorite things about that game is how it so clearly knew who it was talking to. The entire first section of that book is just a history of magical girl anime, and you can tell it's written by people who love magical girls and know all of it. Like, there's a really cute bit where it's like, oh man, Sally the Witch. Yeah, you should go see Sally the Witch. Sally the Witch hadn't been released in English yet. Like, there was no way for the six-year-olds buying this game to buy Sally the Witch. But the same way, it's like, this is so cool, you have to see it. And then it's like, and, you know, it was aimed at teen girls, so it worked in a lot of ways to meet them where they were. It's like, oh, you see how Usagi writes a diary in the show? Well, we're going to give you a diary as well. And you should write about what you're doing in the game. You'd write about that. Sailor Moon's got a big thing of fashion, so we're going to give you space to write down what your clothes are. Is there a mechanical benefit to that? No. But in the show, she'd go on about dresses, so why can't your character? And it's that idea of knowing your audience and talking to a very specific group of people. You know, and again, my favorite thing I was doing that game is that the section on Moonlight Knight, who is a filler character, is massive. And you can just clearly tell the writer just really liked Moonlight Knight and was like, I love Moonlight Knight. You will include him in your campaign. So this is not optional.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's that moment you kind of feel like, oh, hey. Me and the writer are talking to the page. It isn't me talking to, you know, the HR department and the financial department who have decided that this word will make us $50 extra per year. I'm talking to the weirdo who wrote this and their weird obsession with Moonlight Knight, and shine on, you crazy diamond. You know, it's great. I think that's the thing I like to aim for in my games. You know, my games are stupid, inherently so. But sometimes it's a case of, hey, I hope someone sees that and gets the joke. And if you don't get the joke, well, the joke isn't for you.
That's a great mindset to approach that with. And I will use that as a transition point to circle back around to your projects in particular again. For anybody who is just starting off and wanting to get into designing TTRPGs, do you have any advice that you would give to them? Or if you were to put yourself in the shoes of your past self when you were just starting to design, is there anything that you wish you knew then that you know now?
Oh, there's so much advice you can give. I think the big one is that you've just got to start. Again, it's that thing of people wait for sort of permission. No one is going to give you permission. You've just kind of got to roll into it and go with it. And, you know, your first work is going to be crap. Is what it is. It means nothing. I think the thing people underestimate when they start TTRPGs is you have to learn a lot more skills than you think you do. And that is unfortunate because all skills have a learning curve. So starting TTRPGs doesn't just mean you're going to be bad at one thing. You're going to be bad at six things at once. And you just kind of got to go, well, this is just how it's going to be for a little bit. But over time, you will get better at that. And you have to start improving. I think one of the big things, you've got to get used to finishing stuff. So I know you say I'm prolific. I would argue against that I'm prolific and just that I finish things. I think a big problem you see a lot of new developers do is they get sucked into the perfection hole where like, oh man, I could just spend another couple of months just tweaking this. Oh, I could swap four of the adjectives. What you're doing is you're avoiding finishing something because you don't have faith in it. I was talking to someone about this a couple of months ago now who has a background in psychology and like, oh yeah, that's an anxiety coping mechanism. It's like, oh, you know, that makes perfect sense now I think about it. It's so simple, but it is true. No one has to see it if you never do it, but you have to get used to finishing things. It is unfortunately also how you move on in the industry. If you want to get roles writing, you've got to have stuff to show people. To have stuff to show people, you've just got to have stuff out there. Yeah, it's unfortunate, but this is why I always suggest starting with game jams a little bit, especially format jams, because they do kind of force you to go, you have 2 months. At the end of 2 months, this is going out whether you like it or not. And I will say, if you have friends into design, get them to support you. Basically have them tell you, this is going up in 2 months, even if I have to come to your house and rip the file off myself and do it. Because you can just not sit there working on one game for 25 years. You know, you say one more month, but it doesn't mean one more month. It means one more month I find something else to change, and then one more month I find something else to change. It's understandable, but you've got to finish things. And it's a skill. It's a skill we don't talk about enough, but it is a skill. I'll say again, the game jam, starting small. I know a lot of people who come into this wanting to make Pathfinder, wanting to make Cyberpunk. Those are big projects for a reason. It's not a good way to start. You're just going to, you know, same way when you see those video game Kickstarters where it's a one-man dev team trying to remake Skyrim. It's like, I admire your passion and it's a cool dream to have. You're just not going to be able to. There's a reason when you learn coding, we teach you to make Pong, we teach you to make Pac-Man, we teach you to make Donkey Kong. We don't say make GTA 6. Because, again, you have a chance to learn because you're stuck doing the one thing forever. And the other thing is you've got to do is you've got to learn to not compare yourself. The unfortunate problem with this is people come in and the games they look for inspiration are the ones that are easy to find, the ones that are in big bookstores. Those are games made by multinational conglomerates that have teams of, you know, I counted how many people are in the Pathfinder book. It's about 115.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I may be off there. I apologize if you're number 116. I wasn't admitting you. And they have a budget. They work 9 to 5 on that game. They have a team of consultants. They have, you know, a budget of probably in the high 100,000s, maybe topping 1 million. They can do a lot of stuff you can't. You know, your game is never going to look as good as that. Never going to be as big as that. That's fine. When your little cousin comes to you with their crayon drawing, you don't grab them by the lapels, take them to the Louvre and show them Guernica and go, look, look. That would be stupid. Of course it's not going to be Guernica. You've got to imagine yourself as that little cousin for a brief moment and go, would I say to someone who was just starting out? No. Compare yourself to other indie games. Again, it's why I always love format game jams. Stuff like the business card jam or the bookmark jam or the one-page jam, which is currently ongoing, are great ways to sort of compare yourself to others in that by having that strict format, it does undercut some of the advantages of having money. It does undercut some of the advantages of having a bigger team because there is only so much you can do on one page. Again, don't still go comparing yourself to big teams, but at least you can have an idea of like, okay, how did I approach this? How could I approach this better next time? And yeah, it's unfortunate. It's something I think a lot of devs fall into is that, yeah, you make your first thing, you know, well, I could have made it better. You don't have the resources. Economics are a thing. Another tip I'll just give is that your first game is going to be hard. It's going to be very, very hard because you've got to learn your workflows. Workflows are boring, but they exist. you probably have this as someone who edits podcasts. The first podcast you edit will take about 4 hours because you've got to work out where everything goes in the software. You've got to find where you put the overlay. Podcasts I edit, the first one took me about 4 hours to edit because of that. I had to where do I put this? Now I know where I have all my folders laid out. I know where they go. You can do it in an hour. You've got to get that sort of mechanism down. And, over time, you start knowing little things, how to make things look better faster, where to find things, even finding resources. Hey, if I want to find this kind of art, I look on this site. Oh, hey, this would look great with this painting. Or, this is how I do a margin. Yeah, I said when I was doing that first edit, I had to look up how to do something in Resolve. So that was 25 minutes of looking through tutorials. Never have to do that again now. I know how to do it. Same with developing a TTRPG. You will learn and you will get faster over time and things will get smoother. When you start a TTRPG on your own, you are doing writing, layout, image editing. You're going to be crap at all of them. But over time, you will get slightly better at each of them, and those things will become faster, they'll become easier, and they'll become second nature. It is the boring part of these kind of conversations.
Yeah.
But I wish I could say that there was, go to the ancient temple of Candia and put an offering down and you'll be blessed. No, you just have to do them. You will hate yourself for a brief period. There will be the nights where you go, I'm useless at everything. Father was right. But then in 2 weeks, you'll look back and then go, what was I going on about? Man, I'm overdramatic. I remember the absolute stress of laying out my first game and it looked crap. And now I look at it and go, what was I complaining about? This is really easy. And it's not easy. It's the fact I just got the skills and, I've spent years honing it. Yeah, it is what it is.
To quote the wisdom of Adventure Time, being bad at something is the first step to being sort of okay at something.
Exactly. Advice for life. We were talking about earlier as well, same with podcasts, of you've got to never shut up. I think that's something that people struggle with. Because if you're a solo dev, you don't just have to do the writing, you have to do the marketing. And marketing early on, I'm not sure, maybe this is me, I'm British, so we have hilarious social codes on when it is okay to like yourself and when, as a nation, you kind of expect to hate yourself a little bit. I blame the weather, personally. But that marketing, you just got to learn to do it. Yeah, you've got to learn. I think people feel like, oh, people will judge me if I say buy my thing. No, that is what you've got to do. It's going to feel horrible. It's going to feel awkward. You've got to make the social media posts. For me, I never got around to liking that part of doing it. I never did. I just got to the point of where I just accept the fact I hate doing it. It is, for me, the equivalent of taking out the trash.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, this job sucks. I don't want to do it, but I've got to do it, so we'll do it. And then I can go and do something much more interesting when this is done. And, I said I wouldn't have got a lot of the jobs I did unless I started talking to people and started being like, hey, I write this stuff. If you want it, you've got to come to me for us. That said, one of my first things I got, when I got offered a job was, can you write something for my game? I was like, yeah, sure. What do you want? And they sent me a contract. There was a brief moment of like, oh, you mean like job? Oh, okay. This isn't just me like doing a favor for you. This is actually something we're doing. It's like, we're doing a capitalism transaction here. Oh dear. And they only knew I did stuff because I was saying I did stuff. Spotlighting of small media is very hard. Places do not spotlight well. So you have to say that. And I say this a lot. I said, again, I run a website called Library of Words, where I review specifically my sort of thesis of that site is to talk about the games no one else will. And I get people like, oh, I wish you'd cover my games. Like, there's a contact form on the site. Have you emailed me? No. I can use Itch's tools, but they're not perfect. I can use drive-through tools. They're terrible. Google will not service me a site full stop recently because it's gone downhill. If you're not telling me that and you're not posting, I might love your game, but I'm never going to find it. Because of that site, because of that philosophy, I think I put more time into searching for games than your average consumer because, I specifically can make these lists and stuff. So if I can't find your game, I don't think a random person is going to find it either. Even if they love, it could be their favorite game in the world. They could love the concept. But if you're not saying it, it's the old joke of, a restaurant is only as good as its marketing.
Yeah.
You may make the best cock of this side of the Rhine. If you are in a cupboard at the back of a Safeway, no one's going to know you're there. And no one's going to go, well, I'm going to have a look in this cupboard just in case there's lovely food here. And again, it sucks, but you got to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, to that end, I will give you an opportunity to do that right now. For anybody wanting to look into your work and your content, where do you recommend they start?
to start with the games, I used to always say you have one ability, the ability to fuck this up. Because that is a very simple game that is mechanically recreating the Three Stooges. Because I love my old slapstick comedy, but recently I've switched to a game called Polter, because I think it is the most... I jokingly call my design clown core, because I draw a lot of inspiration from the circus, and that is that to be a clown, you sometimes got to be stupid. And Polter is that. Polter is a game where you play as a freelance ghost removal technician in a world where ghostbusting has become Uber. And you fight ghosts by doing certain things. You earn time, and that lets you erase a board at the end. You've got to erase as quickly as possible to get rid of the ghost. You've got to literally bust the ghost by erasing it. And I think that is just the type of design I work with a lot of, like, this is fun, this is kinetic, it's a little bit silly. It's also one of my favorite designs of a book, because the whole book is organized to look like you're looking out on the screen of a smartphone, complete with a load of weird ads. Some of the adverts reference other things I've done. Like, there's the haunted TV channel, Channel 36, that I bring up a lot. They have a little advert. There's Wobbly Land, which is a haunted theme park that appeared in another game, has a little advert. So for me, it's like, it's both really good microcosm design and something I really love, because it's just me showing off that, hey, these are all these things I love that I've made. It references a recurring joke of mine, which is hidden in a lot of my games, is mentions of a character, a detective who no one likes, who often dies, who is very clearly me. As for Lynx, oh gosh, deep breaths, everybody. I apologize for this. So if you want to find all my stuff, that includes all my TTRPGs, all my freelance writing, all of my podcasting stuff, that is on starshinescribbles.com. If you just want the games, they're on itch, starshinescribbles.itch.io. If you want me to see me on social media where you can hear me randomly talk about things like pro wrestling and theme parks, that is starshinescribbles.bluesky.social. And then if you want to see me reviewing TTRPGs, you go to libraryofwords.com. And again, to really re-stress that earlier point I made, if you have a game and you think, yeah, I would like to maybe see this reviewed, libraryofwords.com has an about page, has an email address. You can go onto that email address immediately, and I will have a look-see. I do not bite, so do not feel that you're going to have me publicly slandering you for your game. I review the things I like because I like them. And then finally, if you go on StarTrekScribbles.com, you will find the TTRPG Creative Master Post, which is a database I maintain of free, cheap Creative Commons creation resources for new developers. Last count, I think we have about 300 links on that page to stock images of all types of game systems that you can hack, places to find video, sound, fonts. Yeah, please make use of that, because every 6 months I get a message from my hosting provider saying that's too many links. So yeah, the more people who use it, the more people that justify me having done my hosting provider. Please stop emailing by the number of links.
Fantastic. All of those resources will be in the description of this episode.
So you'll get a comment about the number of links.
I will get a comment about the number of links. But before we wrap up, I just want to make sure if there's any other miscellaneous topics that you want to touch on that we haven't had an opportunity to address. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you want to make sure that we do?
Yes. I actually want to talk a little bit about my journalism for a brief second. Again, is that a thing of reaching out to people is very, very important. One of the biggest tips I can give you if you want your game to be covered on somewhere is to make sure you have a good variety of art. And when I say good variety of art, I don't mean commissioning $400 pieces. Again, if you commission artists, do it. Recommend it. It's lovely fun. But having just a big version of your logo available, having a banner version of your logo available is amazing. It saves me a lot of time. But when I work with other places, like, say, like Polygon, Gay Dreadful, they'll always ask you, what does the image team need to do? And if I can say, well, here's the banner already made for this entry in this list, for this article, here's the art already made, they are so much more likely to let me run something than if I have to say, well, there's this kind of bit of word art here, but it's 400 by 200. So the image team are going to have to remake it. They're going to have to find a background image. Again, it sucks that is something that we have to do, but obviously everything is a time constraint. So if you want your game covered, even if you want it on podcast as well, it's very helpful. Get that pack of just, again, even if it is just InGIMP, which is a open source photo editor, that is just your word art in different sizes. You know, make sure one's in 1080p. It saves everyone a lot of time. And in those moments, if people have a choice between, I've got a week to get this out, I have the one where all the image work is already done for me, or the one I'm going to have to make all the images from scratch, they're going to go for the one where the images are made. Don't think you have to spend a lot of money on it, but it's just very important. And I'll say on that as well, have a good elevator pitch. When you're doing game descriptions, one of the biggest problems I see, especially if you're on itch, is that just a blank page. It ruins your search ranking, which is, I hate the fact that is the game. But if I don't know what a game is, the chances of me downloading it are much smaller. Even if it is just two sentences saying, this is a game about dogs. It's for four players. It uses D12s. That immediately, one, lets people know what it is. So people who want, like, oh, cool, I want a TTRPG Dogs, will download it. It means that people who don't want that kind of game won't feel like they've been ripped off. It means if someone picks it up on a whim, they're going to be like, well, I can't play this because I don't have this specific dice. It's, again, it's a small detail, but it makes the world of difference to how your games will get covered, how your games will get looked at. And again, it's so nice for sort of people who search for new games. Just give them that little bit. It doesn't have to be like big copy. And probably my final thing on that was also is knowing your worth is something we don't talk about enough in TTRPG design. There are a lot of fly-by-night dicks who will try and lowball you, will try and get something for free. People exist online in the TTRPG space who are very public. Most of them, if you DM them and go, hey, you know, I don't know this person, they made me this offer and I'm unsure about it, will be happy to be like, okay, yeah, no, that's clearly nonsense. Or, you know, I've worked with them and they're cool. You know, it's the same in the writing community. There are whisper networks that you can tell you, like, hey, if, you know, this person just undercharged you, this person doesn't pay. Don't be afraid to reach out if you feel, if your gut says something about this is feels off, feels too good to be true. Most people in the community would be more than happy to just have a look and give you that advice. Because, you know, all of us starting out, we're in that same position where we took a job. It's like, well, didn't get paid for it. You know, didn't get my name on it. So, and yeah, you want to make sure that doesn't happen to other people. So feel free to reach out. Don't feel that you're alone.
Awesome. Well, thank you again so much for sitting down to chat with me. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thank you to all of you for listening. One more time, everybody, I'm Danger Dan Jers, the GM and host of D&D Dark. I've been chatting with Starshine Scribbles, otherwise known as Jonathan Greenall, and this has been Table Talk. And I hope you enjoyed what we brought to the table. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Table Talk, created, hosted, and edited by myself, Danger Dan Jers, with artwork by Jordan Nelson. Our guest this episode was Jonathan Greenall, also known as Starshine Scribbles. Links to their work can be found in the episode description. If you're interested in being a guest on this show, reach out to us at dndarkpodcast@gmail.com. Our theme song and outro was created by Jeremy Vellucci. Check out more of his works on Instagram at jeremyvellucci_wreckoftime. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time we have a guest take a seat at the table.
Hello and welcome to Super Stryford Regency Rangers, a comedy action adventure loosely based on Sentai and Sensibility by 9th Level Games and starring some of Stratford's most colorful creatures.
You may call me Adrian Alucard Depeche. If you know what my father did, it could be bad.
Looking matronly with her face hidden behind a fan stands the Kuchisake Ona. Doesn't everyone think she's beautiful?
My name is Sir Gordon Topham Hatt. Pleasure to meet you. I like to make stuff go boom.
My name is Richard Milo Renfield.
He's back.
No, he's just still like that. Oh, God.
Hi, I'm Jordan, and I play Frederick the Loafer.
Oh, my God. Is this the dude that was, like, in that one episode of D&D Dark?
It is the deepest cut of inside jokes that could be made. God.
Are you married, miss?
I am not married.
Kuchisake leans immediately to the group, just pulls a quick huddle. We need to get this trollop out of this fucking town.
We go fight?
I meet you at dawn tomorrow morning.
It's date.
I hope to find love like that someday.
She says that I hit her. I did not hit her. It's not bullshit. I did not. And as you're walking, he just keeps following you.
Oh, God. I believe I have made an unfortunate ally.
On his hips are two pistols, on his back are two rifles, and on his chest, a triple barrel shotgun.
Oh, my God.
I will destroy all of you and destroy this town.
D&D Dark presents Super Stratford Regency Rangers, premiering Wednesday, May 27th, only on patreon.com/dnddarkpodcast.
Hello and welcome to Super Stratford Regency Rangers, a comedy action adventure loosely based on Sentai and Sensibility by 9th Level Games and starring some of Stratford's most colorful creatures.
You may call me Adrian Alucard Depeche. If you know what my father did, it could be bad.
Looking matronly with her face hidden behind a fan stands the Kuchisake Ona. Doesn't everyone think she's beautiful?
My name is Sir Gordon Topham Hatt. Pleasure to meet you. I like to make stuff go boom.
My name is Richard Milo Renfield.
He's back.
He's just still like that. Oh, God.
Hi, I'm Jordan, and I play Frederick the Loafer.
My God, is this the dude that was like... in that one episode of Sea and Dark?
It is the deepest cut of inside jokes that could be made.
Are you, married, miss?
I am not married.
Kuchisake leans immediately to the group, just pulls a quick huddle. We need to get this trollop out of this fucking town.
We go fight?
I meet you at dawn tomorrow morning.
It's... date.
I hope to find love like that someday.
She says that I hit her. I did not hit her. It's not bullshit. I did not. And as you're walking, he just keeps following you.
Oh, God. I believe I have made an unfortunate ally.
On his hips are two pistols. On his back are two rifles. And on his chest, a triple barrel shotgun.
Oh, my God.
I will destroy all of you and destroy this town.
D&D Dark presents Super Stratford Regency Rangers, premiering Wednesday, May 27th, only on patreon.com/D&D Dark Podcast.